It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you and also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, M-I-D-I.
This past week, the Chicago Community Trust and the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy released a report on the accumulation and the distribution of wealth in the Chicago area. Now, some of this may not surprise you, but you may find it troubling. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. The report is called The Color of Wealth in Chicago, and as you might imagine, it looks at wealth in the Chicago metropolitan area from the perspective of race and ethnicity. Spoiler alert, the study found major inequities. My guests this weekend are the principal forces around the report. Andrea Sions is the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust. She first was named to that post in 2022. Derek Hamilton is a professor of economics and urban policy, and he is the founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy. And I will welcome both of you to this program, and thank you for doing this.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Andrea Sions, let me start with you. When people think of wealth, they normally center it on what somebody earns and then start reasoning from there. Why focus this study on wealth versus salaries?
What we have not been able to understand by looking just at income, and income inequality is still something we should be concerned about, is that even at higher incomes, we see real differences in the assets people can rely on to get through an emergency, to get through a crisis, and to plan for their future, which is what wealth is, right? The what's left over after you've paid all your debts and you've, you know, paid all your bills, you have some resources at your disposal that you can rely on when you lose a job unexpectedly, when someone in your family falls ill unexpectedly, when you want to buy a home and become a homeowner. That is what wealth allows people to do. And it makes a big difference in a family's well-being, peace of mind, all of the things that we all aspire to.
And Derek Hamilton, once you decide that you're going to study wealth, how do you go about determining and measuring that concept for the people that you are studying or surveying?
You know, around the mid-1980s, we started to systematically do more than measure income. And we developed modules to ask about various forms in which people store assets, as well as the debts that they have. And then over time, simply by collecting that data, we've been able to implement new policies and think about inequality and disparity in different ways.
Now, Professor Hamilton, I suppose the headline finding in this report is about net worth. So let's start there. at least from my reading, the racial disparities couldn't be more stark.
It's true. And unfortunately, it's not unique to Chicago. And also, it's not unique across time. We've had dramatic improvements in reductions in racial and ethnic metrics like education and income. Unfortunately, they've stagnated. So real quick, from a historical standpoint, from like the mid-1940s up to the early 1970s, dramatic reductions in income inequality. It stagnated since. But when it comes to wealth, there essentially has never been a Black and brown middle class when it comes to wealth. And some of the figures we uncovered in Chicago is that for the Black population in Chicago, they essentially have no wealth. Once you net out the debt that they owe, they essentially have no wealth. And it's not as if the other communities of color are doing well either. You know, in the report, we disaggregated the Latino, Latina, Latinx population by country of origin. We also disaggregated by Puerto Rican ancestry. And what we find for those groups, those households that are Mexican and foreign born, they have about $6,000 in net worth. Those that have lineage where a head was born in the U.S., well, they have more, but substantially less than the $210,000 that the typical median white family in Chicago has.
And I want to dwell on this for just a second, because you went through it, but how, you know, for African-American families, and we're talking median income, which for people who don't get that concept, it means basically half of the people in the survey did better and half did worse, if my math, poor math history is any help. But how do you end up with zero wealth, which is what the report did? And I mean, that figure jumped out at me.
Yeah, I mean, it's alarming. And again, it is a figure, as you accurately describe, of the typical person. If we were to look at the mean wealth, and we have, the mean wealth is not zero. The disparities across mean wealth, across race and ethnicity, are even more pronounced. And that's in part because wealth is highly concentrated. So even for the white population, you'll find that there is some extreme wealth at the top. And that's not unique to Chicago. That's the pattern in the U.S. in general that would drag the mean figure up. But why we focus on the median is because that's typical. And as you described, it is half the group is above and half the group is below. So we want to find out what is the typical experience across race and ethnicity. You know, critical race theorists use the concept of property rights and an identity. So looking at the median, you know, so in this scenario, we're not looking at the extreme wealth and on either end, the extreme low or the extreme top. And if we look at what's typical, sadly, there's a clustering of wealth, particularly for Black people, hovering around not having any financial agency as measured by wealth.
Andrea Saenz, what is it saying about our economy or even our society that we can actually have a measurable group of people with numbers like that?
I mean, what it says to us, right, is a couple things. One, you know, I just want to pause to say, like, these are families, these are people that are struggling to make ends meet that we're talking about. So just taking a moment to, you know, step back into our humanity and imagine what it's like to try to get through week by week, month by month, without having any cushion to rely on. Some of us have lived that and know how stressful it can be. So I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. Stepping back from that, what we see is just a pattern, right? This is not about, you know, describing every white family, every Black family, every Mexican family, every Puerto Rican family. It's about stepping back and looking at this pattern of who has access and who has opportunity to build wealth and to build financial stability, and who in Chicago today still does not, right? And, you know, we understand that we got here by, if we examine our history and the policies and the way in which housing has been, available to certain groups at certain times based on their race and ethnicity, and unavailable to certain groups at certain times based on their race and ethnicity, and all the waves of xenophobia that our country has gone through over our history, helps explain how we got to this situation today. And what we want to focus on is, okay, how do we use policy and how do we use the tools that we have at our disposal? As a philanthropic organization, we have some tools available to us. We can invest in community-based organizations that are working to reverse these trends, and we do that. How can you, if you are a business leader, use your role in your position to make decisions, set policies that might help us reverse this trend? You know, how are you hiring? What do your hiring policies look like? How are you using your resources to procure services from businesses, et cetera? That's what we want to focus our efforts on. When we look at this report, it is not surprising, unfortunately. We've been working on these issues for a number of years at the Chicago Community Trust. And what this does is just add another layer of data to information that we've seen nationally and that we've seen from other sources of information about how households in Chicago are faring across racial and ethnic lines. So the fact that it is a pattern that is repeated over time and over multiple ways to analyze it tells us that there's something in the way that we are providing opportunity to Chicagoans that is off, right? And what can we do to correct that?
And I want to make sure that we do talk about some of the potential solutions or at least ways of addressing it. But one other thing that struck me, and also I'm going to want to touch a couple of individual elements of the wealth. But all through this report, with some exceptions, Latino families have been in slightly better financial shape than African American families. Can you talk a little bit about what are the factors that might account for that? Because, you know, in so many other things, in our policies, even usually because of the numbers in population, there's more attention paid to African-American families in contracting and the like than Latino families. But what's going on where the wealth is stronger within Latino families?
You know, that begs for another study. I would say I would look at our friends who are researchers to help us dig into those numbers. But, you know, I have a couple hypotheses, sort of armchair researcher hypotheses. And it might be about how we define households. So this study is done at the household level. I don't think that there's a distinction or details about, you know, how many people are in that household. Might it be that there are more multi-generational families that are pooling their resources together in Latino households than might be the case for other groups? You know, anecdotally, I can say that that's what I see in the work that we do in Chicago, but and that might be part of what the difference is. I don't know that you can attribute it to necessarily greater opportunity. You might be able to, and we know that anti-Black racism is strong and it is persistent and it is at the heart of so many things that we are still struggling with as a society. So that might be part of it as well.
And Professor Hamilton, would you like to add anything to this?
You know, we can acknowledge that originally there were indigenous people on this land to begin with in Chicago. We should at least begin and acknowledge that. And then I would argue that in America, this social construct of race and ethnicity is anchored on Blackness. We have a structure that has, so when you hear framing of anti-Blackness, there's an anchoring of this othering by which, when we get into the concepts of critical race theory and think about property and right whiteness, we often frame it as white, non-white. In earnest, I think it's a Black, non-Black identity structure in America by which we other. And various immigrant groups aren't immune to that. Various immigrant groups get othered as well. So we can get into the nuance, but at the end, justice is one where regardless of race and ethnicity, the dismal numbers that Black, Latinx, and other groups held, a lot of asset poor white individuals see, that's unjust. And in the end, when we get to the solutions, we have to get to a point where something like your race or ethnicity has aesthetic value. One should be proud of their heritage and culture. A denial of that is inhumane, if you ask me. We should be proud of our ancestry. But when it comes to transaction, those attributes should have no bearing whatsoever. But again, I just want to emphasize, America, at least since 1619, has been founded upon an anti-Blackness in which Black is the anchor of other.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Dellamore, and we're talking about racial and ethnic disparities in wealth across Chicagoland and, frankly, across the country as well. My guests are Andrea Sions, President and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, and Derek Hamilton, Founding Director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. I just wanted to touch on a couple of elements in perhaps in some ways going in opposite directions. The first is credit, because that was part of the things that you among the things you measured. And maybe, Professor Hamilton, maybe even the exact opposite of wealth, but that was a factor in this report. Can you talk a little bit about what you found?
You know, in terms of clarity, from an accounting standpoint, the biggest component of the Black, white, white Latinx inequities and wealth is centered on assets. Essentially, white people have a great deal more assets than the other populations. But that is not to dismiss, as you point out, some of the strong variations in debt and the types of debt. You find that there are big disparities in medical debt. And medical debt is one of the main reasons why a family who goes bankrupt would go bankrupt. We find large variations in student loan debt. And here we have a scenario of an ethos of society that says, go get an education to better yourself, but yet we saddle our young people with the albatross of debt, student loan debt, and then payday lending debt, where these are last resort credit options after you have no other options. And in a context where there's volatility in how much you earn from week to week and how much you actually get to work from week to week as we fissure our labor force more and more, we see that even though from an accounting standpoint, the vast bulk of the wealth gap is accounted for in the asset dimension, this debt is debilitating. We saddle families, particularly Latinx and Black families, with more and more of their income and wages going towards servicing the debt of someone else. That's a problem. You know, I'd say it's a modern day indentitude in which we saddle people. Debt becomes weaponized. The last point I'll make on it is, you know, ideally you want debt to be a sovereign choice that people choose to access good credit to better themselves, not debt as a last resort where people don't have agency but to take out debt. That's a big problem.
Mm-hmm. And I want to turn to the other side of the ledger here, and that is banking. Andrea Sions, a substantial number of non-whites don't have traditional checking or savings accounts. I would think that has some serious effects. And also, I would ask, is this an issue of availability, or is it financial literacy, or maybe both?
You know, what we're seeing is it's a combination of things. It starts with the difference in the number of actual banks, physical buildings that are banks in low-income neighborhoods. And that's something that we see across the country, right? So there, it's just, you know, human nature and convenience. Do you see it? Is it in your neighborhood? Is it for me? If it's not there, it may not be. Move on to another option. What we also see is that, you know, folks don't always feel like they are being the sort of target customer of these financial institutions, and so may not get the kind of information and access to the options that someone in a more affluent community might get. And so may not really understand how to use the tools that are available that are low cost and convenient and secure to do banking. And so what we have seen is with community-based organizations we support to do all kinds of work around credit repair and getting people ready to buy homes, getting people mortgage ready, is that that introduction to a productive banking relationship can be a really important step. And when it is available and when a bank has products that are accessible to people of low income that are not excessively high fees, that, you know, that are flexible in ways they need to be flexible, that makes a really big difference for a family's ability to participate in the economy in healthy ways.
Yeah. And I would point out that this is just anecdotally, for people who do have assets, some assets, and they're in a bank, the bank will call you to tell you, hey, you have assets. We have ways for you to do even better with those assets and give you instructions. I mean, they want to be your banker and can help you invest your money. If you don't have assets or don't have enough assets, no one calls you. No one tries to help you to build your wealth. And is that something that the banking industry needs to realize that maybe they could even be making more money from their customers and helping their customers make more money? Professor Hamilton, can you talk a little bit about the way institutions could be part of the solution?
Well, we can go back to the 2008 crisis. Maybe some of those poor families should not take that call if a bank is calling them. We do have that history also of predation also. You know, here's where I think we need to go. Banks are a for-profit entity, and they are in the business of making resources. They should be responsible. They should be responsible to their employees, and they should be responsible to the public. That's for sure. But I ultimately believe that we need a public sector to make sure that vulnerable populations, particularly in the 21st century, have access to something as basic as an account. And the technology to do so is not beyond us. You know, I'll give a quick example. CalWORKS, right now, the state of California is doing demonstrations around providing electronic accounts in a way that people who might have to pay fees, high banking fees that they can't afford, because perhaps that might not be the target population for a bank when they're offering account services, the public can be a mechanism that's cost effective, universal, to provide quality access to people so that they can have something as basic as an account.
That's a good point to bring up, and that gets us into what we wanted to talk about. Andrea Sens, we need to talk about some potential solutions. Or the solutions may be too strong a word in this case, but and government funded trusts is one thing. What are some of the things that could be done both in the philanthropic sector and in government and business?
So, you know, trying to break it down to the most basic, right? How do we help families who have not had access to building assets, build those assets, doing so from relatively modest means and moving people into a place where they have the wherewithal to, you know, retire with some stability and hopefully pass assets on to the next generation so we're not here again, you know, 10, 20 years from now with, the next generation starting out from zero or behind zero. The biggest asset that most Americans will own is a home, right? So that is how many people begin to build wealth that they can pass along to their families. There are many different sort of initiatives underway across Chicago, getting very creative about how to help moderate income people get into a position where they can afford a mortgage, even in these really difficult times with high interest rates. There are community-based organizations that are testing out lots of different ways to help people get into that first home so that they can have this asset that grows over time. We know that for homes to appreciate in value and to actually become an asset for a family, they need to be in neighborhoods where there's vitality, where there are amenities. And so there's a lot of work going on across the city and across the region in building a neighborhood's economic vitality through economic development efforts, building, you know, businesses, getting, you know, amenities into the community is another thing that we're engaged with. There's a philanthropic role. There's obviously a business investment role. There's a public role to help enable these kinds of developments in neighborhoods that haven't seen investment in many decades that is starting to take root and to have some momentum. When these things start to stack up on top of each other, then you see the kind of trends and change that we want. The other thing is income. You know, we've talked about the fact that wealth is a better measure of financial well-being than it is income, but people still need to be able to have the kinds of income and the kind of job that allows you to build assets over time as a starting point. So an income that allows for a little bit of savings, a job that allows for the kinds of benefits that don't make you go into medical debt to get basic medical services. All of those things are important. And we see a lot of momentum in Chicago in particular. The city colleges, Chicago State University, National Lewis University have all been really focused on making sure increasing shares of Chicago's Black and Latino students are in those universities, are on track to graduate, are moving into jobs. They're taking it upon themselves to go beyond the graduation date and say, our commitment to this student is that the student is able to enter a career that allows them to support themselves. So all of this momentum is starting to, I would say, layer on top of each other. This is not a simple issue. And so we're not talking about a very simple silver bullet solution. We're talking about a set of strategies that together can turn the tide for Chicago communities.
And Professor Hamilton, one of the other things that people are hearing more and more about is the guaranteed income. And we are seeing some pilot programs starting here in Chicago. Cook County is starting one. There are some other municipalities that are trying it. What are you seeing on the landscape that suggests that this can be a help? Does something else need to come along with it so that people actually make better use or best use of that income or that money if it comes?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we need paradigm shift. What we have been doing for the last 50, 60 years has not worked. And then we can look beyond that last 50, 60 years and find that at some point we did have paradigm shift, but it was not universally inclusive. So what I'm trying to get at is historically, we implemented the policies and practices that we're advocating today, only it extended to white people and not all people. There's a lot of positive policies that came about from seeding an immigrant white population with capital and the wherewithal to build that capital and pass it down from one generation to the next. When Blacks migrated from the South and when the Latinx population migrated into Chicago, because Chicago's a story of migration for many groups, unfortunately, they didn't have that same infrastructure. So if we look today, we need a paradigm shift, and Cook County is leading. So if we want to find some silver linings, guaranteed income ensures that with this volatility in the workplace in terms of your hours and wages, you're not vulnerable to not being able to meet your subsistence, or you have some additional resources so that you can work and you don't have to get these costly debt that put you into a debt trap over and over again. What do we need to complement it? Well, we need, like we had in the past, again, turn into the history, access to public education without debt. So people should be able to go to college and not be able to accrue the albatross of student loan debt. And then also, if we think about leadership, Cook County took some of the ARPA money to begin demonstrating what it means to cancel or do Jubilee for some families that were saddled with medical debt. So I would trend towards a single payer health system so that in your most vulnerable position when you are sick, you're not faced with the tragic decision around finance in order to get a life-saving intervention.
Well, I'm going to have to make that the last word because we are out of time, but I do want to thank Derek Hamilton, the founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy, and Andrea Sions, the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, for spending this half hour with us. It went really quickly. To our listeners, if you would like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, wbbmnewsradio.com. There's a link on the homepage. You can also find our podcasts on odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
If your day sounds like...
We need the report ASAP.
You deserve Modelo. If you've persevered through, you deserve this rich golden lager with a crisp but refreshing taste. Or if you overcame,
two more.
You deserve this ice cold reward. Modelo, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois. It's
better over here. After investing billions to light up our network, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, right now, you can switch, keep your phone, and we'll pay it off up to $800. See how you can save on every plan versus Verizon and AT&T at T-Mobile.com/keep and switch.
Up to 4 lines via virtual prepaid card. Allow 15 days. Qualifying unlocked device, credit, service, ported 90 plus days with device and eligible carrier and timely redemption required. Card has no cash access and expires in 6 months.
Getting help for mental health shouldn't be as hard as it is. Mindful Therapy Group is here to make your mental health journey as painless as possible. Mindful partners with thousands of licensed clinicians to find the perfect fit for you and also accepts insurance. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com.
This past week, the Chicago Community Trust and the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy released a report on the accumulation and the distribution of wealth in the Chicago area. Now, some of this may not surprise you, but you may find it troubling. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. The report is called The Color of Wealth in Chicago, and as you might imagine, it looks at wealth in the Chicago metropolitan area from the perspective of race and ethnicity. Spoiler alert, the study found major inequities. My guests this weekend are the principal forces around the report. Andrea Sions is the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust. She first was named to that post in 2022. Derek Hamilton is a professor of economics and urban policy, and he is the founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy. And I will welcome both of you to this program, and thank you for doing this.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Andrea Sions, let me start with you. When people think of wealth, they normally center it on what somebody earns and then start reasoning from there. Why focus this study on wealth versus salaries?
What we have not been able to understand by looking just at income, and income inequality is still something we should be concerned about, is that even at higher incomes, we see real differences in the assets people can rely on to get through an emergency, to get through a crisis, and to plan for their future, which is what wealth is, right? The what's left over after you've paid all your debts and you've, you know, paid all your bills, you have some resources at your disposal that you can rely on when you lose a job unexpectedly, when someone in your family falls ill unexpectedly, when you want to buy a home and become a homeowner. That is what wealth allows people to do. And it makes a big difference in a family's well-being, peace of mind, all of the things that we all aspire to.
And Derek Hamilton, once you decide that you're going to study wealth, how do you go about determining and measuring that concept for the people that you are studying or surveying?
You know, around the mid-1980s, we started to systematically do more than measure income. And we developed modules to ask about various forms in which people store assets, as well as the debts that they have. And then over time, simply by collecting that data, we've been able to implement new policies and think about inequality and disparity in different ways.
Now, Professor Hamilton, I suppose the headline finding in this report is about net worth. So let's start there. And at least from my reading, the racial disparities couldn't be more stark.
It's true. And unfortunately, it's not unique to Chicago. And also, it's not unique across time. We've had dramatic improvements in reductions in racial and ethnic metrics like education and income. Unfortunately, they've stagnated. So real quick, from a historical standpoint, from like the mid-1940s up to the early 1970s, dramatic reductions in income inequality. It stagnated since. But when it comes to wealth, there essentially has never been a Black and brown middle class when it comes to wealth. And some of the figures we uncovered in Chicago is that for the Black population in Chicago, they essentially have no wealth. Once you net out the debt that they owe, they essentially have no wealth. And it's not as if the other communities of color are doing well either. You know, in the report, we disaggregated the Latino, Latina, Latinx population by country of origin. And we also disaggregated by Puerto Rican ancestry. And what we find for those groups, those households that are Mexican and foreign born, they have about $6,000 in net worth. Those that have lineage where a head was born in the U.S., well, they have more, but substantially less than the $210,000 that the typical median white family in Chicago has.
And I want to dwell on this for just a second, because you went through it, but how, you know, for African-American families, and we're talking median income, which for people who don't get that concept, it means basically half of the people in the survey did better and half did worse, if my math, poor math history is any help. But how do you end up with zero wealth, which is what the report did? And I mean, that figure jumped out at me.
Yeah, I mean, it's alarming. And again, it is a figure, as you accurately describe, of the typical person. If we were to look at the mean wealth, and we have, the mean wealth is not zero. The disparities across mean wealth, across race and ethnicity, are even more pronounced. And that's in part because wealth is highly concentrated. So even for the white population, you'll find that there is some extreme wealth at the top. And that's not unique to Chicago. That's the pattern in the U.S. in general that would drag the mean figure up. But why we focus on the median is because that's typical. And as you described, it is half the group is above and half the group is below. So we want to find out what is the typical experience across race and ethnicity. You know, critical race theorists use the concept of property rights and an identity. So looking at the median, you know, so in this scenario, we're not looking at the extreme wealth and on either end, the extreme low or the extreme top. And if we look at what's typical, sadly, there's a clustering of wealth, particularly for Black people, hovering around not having any financial agency as measured by wealth.
Andrea Science, what is it saying about our economy or even our society that we can actually have a measurable group of people with numbers like that?
I mean, what it says to us, right, is a couple things. One, you know, I just want to pause to say, like, these are families, these are people that are struggling to make ends meet that we're talking about. So just taking a moment to, you know, step back into our humanity and imagine what it's like to try to get through week by week, month by month without having any cushion to rely on. Some of us have lived that and know how stressful it can be. So I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind. Stepping back from that, what we see is just a pattern, right? This is not about, you know, describing every white family, every Black family, every Mexican family, every Puerto Rican family. It's about stepping back and looking at this pattern of who has access and who has opportunity to build wealth and to build financial stability, and who in Chicago today still does not, right? And, you know, we understand that we got here by, if we examine our history and the policies and the way in which housing has been, available to certain groups at certain times based on their race and ethnicity, and unavailable to certain groups at certain times based on their race and ethnicity, and all the waves of xenophobia that our country has gone through over our history, helps explain how we got to this situation today. And what we want to focus on is, okay, how do we use policy and how do we use the tools that we have at our disposal? As a philanthropic organization, we have some tools available to us. We can invest in community-based organizations that are working to reverse these trends, and we do that. How can you, if you are a business leader, use your role in your position to make decisions, set policies that might help us reverse this trend? You know, how are you hiring? What do your hiring policies look like? How are you using your resources to procure services from businesses, et cetera? That's what we want to focus our efforts on. When we look at this report, it is not surprising, unfortunately. We've been working on these issues for a number of years at the Chicago Community Trust. And what this does is just add another layer of data to information that we've seen nationally and that we've seen from other sources of information about how households in Chicago are faring across racial and ethnic lines. So the fact that it is a pattern that is repeated over time and over multiple ways to analyze it tells us that there's something in the way that we are providing opportunity to Chicagoans that is off, right? And what can we do to correct that?
And I want to make sure that we do talk about some of the potential solutions or at least ways of addressing it. But one other thing that struck me, and also I'm going to want to touch a couple of individual elements of the wealth. But all through this report, with some exceptions, Latino families have been in slightly better financial shape than African American families. Can you talk a little bit about what are the factors that might account for that? Because, you know, in so many other things in our policies, even usually because of the numbers in population, there's more attention paid to African-American families in contracting and the like than Latino families. But what's going on where the wealth is stronger within Latino families?
You know, that begs for another study. I would say I would look at our friends who are researchers to help us dig into those numbers. But, you know, I have a couple hypotheses, sort of armchair researcher hypotheses. And it might be about how we define households. So this study is done at the household level. I don't think that there's a distinction or details about, you know, how many people are in that household. Might it be that there are more multi-generational families that are pooling their resources together in Latino households than might be the case for other groups? You know, anecdotally, I can say that that's what I see in the work that we do in Chicago, but and that might be part of what the difference is. I don't know that you can attribute it to necessarily greater opportunity. You might be able to, and we know that anti-Black racism is strong and it is persistent and it is at the heart of so many things that we are still struggling with as a society. So that might be part of it as well.
And Professor Hamilton, would you like to add anything to this?
You know, we can acknowledge that originally there were indigenous people on this land to begin with in Chicago. We should at least begin and acknowledge that. And then I would argue that in America, this social construct of race and ethnicity is anchored on Blackness. We have a structure that has, so when you hear framing of anti-blackness, there is an anchoring of this othering by which, when we get into the concepts of critical race theory and think about property and right whiteness, we often frame it as white, non-white. In earnest, I think it's a black, non-black identity structure in America by which we other. And various immigrant groups aren't immune to that. Various immigrant groups get othered as well. So we can get into the nuance, but at the end, justice is one where, regardless of race and ethnicity, the dismal numbers that Black, Latinx, and other groups held, a lot of asset poor white individuals see, that's unjust. And in the end, when we get to the solutions, we have to get to a point where something like your race or ethnicity has aesthetic value. One should be proud of their heritage and culture. A denial of that is inhumane, if you ask me. We should be proud of our ancestry. But when it comes to transaction, those attributes should have no bearing whatsoever. But again, I just want to emphasize, America, at least since 1619, has been founded upon an anti-blackness in which black is the anchor of other.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm Craig Dellamore, and we're talking about racial and ethnic disparities in wealth across Chicagoland and, frankly, across the country as well. My guests are Andrea Sions, President and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, and Derek Hamilton, Founding Director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy at the New School. I just wanted to touch on a couple of elements in perhaps in some ways going in opposite directions. The first is credit, because that was part of the things that you among the things you measured. And maybe, Professor Hamilton, maybe even the exact opposite of wealth, but that was a factor in this report. Can you talk a little bit about what you found?
You know, in terms of clarity, from an accounting standpoint, the biggest component of the Black, white, white Latinx inequities and wealth is centered on assets. Essentially, white people have a great deal more assets than the other populations. But that is not to dismiss, as you point out, some of the strong variations in debt and the types of debt. You find that there are big disparities in medical debt. And medical debt is one of the main reasons why a family who goes bankrupt would go bankrupt. We find large variations in student loan debt. And here we have a scenario of an ethos of society that says, go get an education to better yourself. But yet we saddle our young people with the albatross of debt, student loan debt, and then payday lending debt, where these are last resort credit options after you have no other options. And in a context where there's volatility in how much you earn from week to week and how much you actually get to work from week to week as we fissure our labor force more and more, we see that even though from an accounting standpoint, the vast bulk of the wealth gap is accounted for in the asset dimension, this debt is debilitating. We saddle families, particularly Latinx and Black families, with more and more of their income and wages going towards servicing the debt of someone else. That's a problem. You know, I'd say it's a modern day indentitude in which we saddle people. Debt becomes weaponized. The last point I'll make on it is, you know, ideally you want debt to be a sovereign choice that people choose to access good credit to better themselves, not debt as a last resort where people don't have agency but to take out debt. That's a big problem.
And I want to turn to the other side of the ledger here, and that is banking. Andrea Sions, a substantial number of non-whites don't have traditional checking or savings accounts. I would think that has some serious effects. And also, I would ask, is this an issue of availability, or is it financial literacy, or maybe both?
You know, what we're seeing is it's a combination of things. It starts with the it starts with the difference in the number of actual banks, physical buildings that are banks in low-income neighborhoods. And that's something that we see across the country, right? So there, it's just, you know, human nature and convenience. Do you see it? Is it in your neighborhood? Is it for me? If it's not there, it may not be. Move on to another option. What we also see is that, you know, folks don't always feel like they are being the sort of target customer of these financial institutions, and so may not get the kind of information and access to the options that someone in a more affluent community might get. And so may not really understand how to use the tools that are available that are low cost and convenient and secure to do banking. And so what we have seen is with community-based organizations we support to do all kinds of work around credit repair and getting people ready to buy homes, getting people mortgage ready, is that that introduction to a productive banking relationship can be a really important step. And when it is available and when a bank has products that are accessible to people of low income, that are not excessively high fees, that, you know, that are flexible in ways they need to be flexible, that makes a really big difference for a family's ability to participate in the economy in healthy ways.
Yeah, and I would point out, this is just anecdotally, you know, for people who do have assets, some assets, and they're in a bank, the bank will call you to tell you, hey, you have assets. We have ways for you to do even better with those assets and give you instructions. I mean, they want to be your banker and can help you invest your money. If you don't have assets or don't have enough assets, no one calls you. No one tries to help you to build your wealth. Is that something that the banking industry needs to realize, that that maybe they could even be making more money from their customers and helping their customers make more money? Professor Hamilton, can you talk a little bit about the way institutions could be part of the solution?
Well, you know, we can go back to the 2008 crisis. Maybe some of those poor families should not take that call if a bank is calling them. We do have that history also of predation also. You know, here's where I think we need to go. Banks are a for-profit entity, and they are in the business of making resources. They should be responsible. They should be responsible to their employees, and they should be responsible to the public. That's for sure. But I ultimately believe that we need a public sector to make sure that vulnerable populations, particularly in the 21st century, have access to something as basic as an account. And the technology to do so is not beyond us. You know, I'll give a quick example. CalWORKS, right now, the state of California is doing demonstrations around providing electronic accounts in a way that people who might have to pay fees, high banking fees that they can't afford, because perhaps that might not be the target population for a bank when they're offering account services, the public can be a mechanism that's cost effective, universal, to provide quality access to people so that they can have something as basic as an account.
That's a good point to bring up, and that gets us into what we wanted to talk about. Andrea Sens, we need to talk about some potential solutions. All the solutions may be too strong a word in this case, but and government funded trusts is one thing. What are some of the things that could be done both in the philanthropic sector and in government and business?
So, you know, trying to break it down to the most basic, right? How do we help families who have not had access to building assets, build those assets, doing so from relatively modest means and moving people into a place where they have the wherewithal to, you know, retire with some stability and hopefully pass assets on to the next generation so we're not here again, you know, 10, 20 years from now with, you know, the next generation starting out from zero or behind zero. The biggest asset that most Americans will own is a home, right? So that is how many people begin to build wealth that they can pass along to their families. There are many different sort of initiatives underway across Chicago, getting very creative about how to help moderate income people get into a position where they can afford a mortgage, even in these really difficult times with high interest rates. There are community-based organizations that are testing out lots of different ways to help people get into that first home so that they can have this asset that grows over time. We know that for homes to appreciate in value and to actually become an asset for a family, they need to be in neighborhoods where there's vitality, where there are amenities. And so there's a lot of work going on across the city and across the region in building a neighborhood's economic vitality through economic development efforts, building, you know, businesses, getting, you know, amenities into the community is another thing that we're engaged with. There's a philanthropic role. There's obviously a business investment role. There's a public role to help enable these kinds of developments in neighborhoods that haven't seen investment in many decades that is starting to take root and to have some momentum. When these things start to stack up on top of each other, then you see the kind of trends and change that we want. The other thing is income. You know, we've talked about the fact that wealth is a better measure of financial well-being than it is income, but people still need to be able to have the kinds of income and the kind of job that allows you to build assets over time as a starting point. So an income that allows for a little bit of savings, a job that allows for the kinds of benefits that don't make you go into medical debt to get basic medical services. All of those things are important. And we see a lot of momentum in Chicago in particular. The city colleges, Chicago State University, National Lewis University have all been really focused on making sure increasing shares of Chicago's Black and Latino students are in those universities, are on track to graduate, are moving into jobs. They're taking it upon themselves to go beyond the graduation date and say, our commitment to this student is that the student is able to enter a career that allows them to support themselves. So all of this momentum is starting to, I would say, layer on top of each other. This is not a simple issue. And so we're not talking about a very simple silver bullet solution. We're talking about a set of strategies that together can turn the tide for Chicago communities.
And Professor Hamilton, one of the other things that people are hearing more and more about is the guaranteed income. And we are seeing some pilot programs starting here in Chicago. Cook County is starting one. There are some other municipalities that are trying it. What are you seeing on the landscape that suggests that this can be a help? Does something else need to come along with it so that people actually make better use or best use of that income or that money if it comes?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we need paradigm shift. What we have been doing for the last 50, 60 years has not worked. And then we can look beyond that last 50, 60 years and find that at some point we did have paradigm shift, but it was not universally inclusive. So what I'm trying to get at is historically, we implemented the policies and practices that we're advocating today, only it extended to white people and not all people. There's a lot of positive policies that came about from seeding an immigrant white population with capital and the wherewithal to build that capital and pass it down from one generation to the next. When Blacks migrated from the South and when the Latinx population migrated into Chicago, because Chicago's a story of migration for many groups, unfortunately, they didn't have that same infrastructure. So if we look today, we need a paradigm shift, and Cook County is leading. So if we want to find some silver linings, guaranteed income ensures that with this volatility in the workplace in terms of your hours and wages, you're not vulnerable to not being able to meet your subsistence, or you have some additional resources so that you can work and you don't have to get these costly debt that put you into a debt trap over and over again. What do we need to complement it? Well, we need, like we had in the past, again, turn into the history, access to public education without debt. So people should be able to go to college and not be able to accrue the albatross of student loan debt. And then also, if we think about leadership, Cook County took some of the ARPA money to begin demonstrating what it means to cancel or do Jubilee for some families that were saddled with medical debt. So I would trend towards a single payer health system so that in your most vulnerable position when you are sick, you're not faced with the tragic decision around finance in order to get a life-saving intervention.
Well, I'm going to have to make that the last word because we are out of time, but I do want to thank Derek Hamilton, the founding director of the Institute on Race, Power, and Political Economy, and Andrea Sions, the president and CEO of the Chicago Community Trust, for spending this half hour with us. It went really quickly. To our listeners, if you would like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, wbbmnewsradio.com. There's a link on the homepage. You can also find our podcasts on odyssey.com. We'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
It's better over here.
Now at T-Mobile, get four 5G phones on us and four lines for $25 a line per month when you switch with eligible trade-ins. All on America's largest 5G network.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees and $10 device connection charge. Phones via 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. Bill credits end if you pay off devices early. See T-Mobile.com.
In the fast-paced world of attacking, speed is everything. And that's where the Furon 7 Plus shines. Engineered for accuracy and precision at a rapid pace, it's your secret weapon on the pitch. Experience overall comfort and precise striking, even in the game's fastest moments. The nylon outsole, with its V-shaped stud configuration, is designed for firm ground, giving you the grip you need to outmaneuver your opponents. Step up your attacking game and learn more and purchase the Furon at NewBalance.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Struggling with mental health shouldn't be the norm. At Mindful Therapy Group, we specialize in connecting you with compassionate therapists to find the perfect fit for you. Mindful Therapy Group accepts most health insurances. Visit mindfultherapygroup.com to start your mental health journey today.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.